Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is actually Saturday, February 3rd, 2007, and this is show number 81. I'm recording an entire day early this week because tomorrow is Super Bowl Sunday in the US, and we have big plans to eat as much as possible, watch some really good commercials, and maybe accidentally see a football thrown around at some point. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch it in high def and through the TiVo, so this year we'll be able to pause, rewind, and maybe even skip some of the game to see the commercials that way. Sure hope our guests aren't too fanatical about that football part to allow that. Well, we'll see. 2 weeks ago, I reviewed Gazmail from gazsquare.com/gazmail, and one of the things I said would keep me with Apple Mail instead is the way Apple Mail lets you use the little pull-down in the bottom right to resize images. So if you're sending a high-res photo to Grandma who's on dial-up, you can just pull down to small, and now Grandma's happy. I did the review for Tim Verporten's MacReviewcast over at MacReviewcast.com, and he got this email back from one of his listeners. Tim, this comment comes in regards to Allison Sheridan's review of Gazmail. Reformatting the size of pictures is part of iPhoto, not Mail. You just need to set iPhoto up for the Mail client you use. I had it working with Entourage prior to making Mail my default email. I'm certain it will work with Gazmail. Also, you cannot make a POP account an IMAP account. Thanks, Oz. Well, I went over to iPhoto and I checked to see if I could change the Mail application there to Gazmail, but it was not an option. There is an option in the general preferences of iPhoto where you can change how photos are emailed, but it only had choices for Mail and Entourage. I don't think this would have really solved the problem anyway. I think this preference just changes how photos get emailed if you click on Email in iPhoto. And that wasn't really the question. What I was trying to do was just be an email, whichever application, Gazmail or iPhoto or Apple Mail, and drag in a photo and change the size right there, not having to launch iPhoto at all. I think that is a built-in feature of Apple Mail, but if somebody else knows something different, I'd sure like to hear about it. Oh, and for the part about not making a POP account into an IMAP account, I wasn't trying to change a POP account into an IMAP account. I was trying to take an existing email service and access it as a POP account or as an IMAP account. And I was able to do both. So anyway, that's the end of that. Last week, I talked about the release of the software Crossover. This is a crazy application that runs on OS X, but it lets you run Windows applications there without running Windows. Parallels and Fusion Beta from VMware both require you to buy and install Windows, but not so with Crossover from CodeWeavers.com. Crossover is $60, so it's outside of the shareware threshold, but it's such an interesting product, I wanted to dig into it a little bit. They have a 60-day trial, so you can really get a chance to find out if it's going to work for you. Crossover doesn't support every application. In fact, the list is a bit limited, but they say that it works well now for the supported applications. I had participated in the beta program, and while I found it promising, it was pretty darn unstable and difficult to find patterns to why it would stop working. I was assured by Jeremy of CodeWeavers that it was worth another look, so here we are. I launched Crossover and saw that I could install from a CD or use the Crossover software installer. The first thing they show you is a list of the software applications that they support. It would be boring for me to read all 32 of them, but how about a sampling? They have Photoshop, Half-Life, well, I'm glad they worked on something important like that, Lotus Notes, a whole slew of Microsoft Office products, but strangely enough, not Access, which would have been nice since it doesn't run on the Mac, but they did include Project and Visio, as well as Quicken. I ran the installer for Internet Explorer, and it told me I had to find the application myself. I checked online, and I found it at Microsoft's site. Unfortunately, they only have Service Pack 1, not Service Pack 2. Evidently, you can't have Service Pack 2 IE without Windows. Oh, wait a minute. I seem to remember some sort of lawsuit about the inseparability of IE and Windows. What was that about? Anyway, my IE6 installation went along quite easily, and after installation, it ran very well. One of my previous complaints was that the graphics were hinky. It would sort of blink the whole image a bit, enough to give you a seizure or something. I was also disappointed because it simply stopped launching eventually. So far, this new version of Crossover appears to be very stable and there's no blinking. It looks just as ugly and old as the old Service Pack 1 version ever was of IE. You can also choose to install unsupported software, but I think that's where I ran into trouble last time, so I decided to try it again. I downloaded the Firefox installation for XP and started on my way through the installation. Throughout Crossover, you'll notice that they talk about bottles a lot. I think it stems from the connection to the technology behind all of this, which is called Wine, which is a recursive acronym that means Wine is not an emulator. Anyway, this bottle thing confuses me because bottles are made to correspond to different operating systems. I'm not really sure why I would want to install Firefox into a 98 bottle versus an XP bottle, though. Not quite sure where I should go there. I pointed the application at the Firefox installer file, and up popped a very Windowsy looking Firefox installation screen. Suddenly, it disappeared after I hit Next, and Crossover said the installer had exited and may not have successfully installed. I tried it in a Windows 98 bottle too and got the same failure. Oh well, they did say it was unsupported. What am I whining about? Overall, it does work better than it did before, but I played with it throughout this week and I found that IE locked up pretty often. Here's the good news. I wrote to the developers and they wrote back right away. They actually assigned two different people to my questions, each taking on the part they're most familiar with. I had also discovered an oddity in the display of a window. The words were kind of getting cut off, and they started working on it right away. I have a lot of confidence in these guys. They're attacking a really hard problem, and they're getting there. So keep an eye on this product. It might actually solve the problem that you have. Quality Control Director Steve made a comment about last week's episode. I'm afraid I used the phrase, "sparked my eye." Now, he was quick to point out that that's not a real phrase. The idiom is really either sparked my interest or caught my eye. Well, this reminded me of a boss I used to have. His name was Bick. And English was not his first language. And he spoke the language very well. But every once in a while, he would mix his metaphors or idioms together. And they would come out really, really funny. Like one time, he said, "pom-pom and its circumstance." I think my favorite one was when he said, "I can smell the blood at the end of the tunnel." Anyway, I'm sure glad Quality Control Director Steve is there to help me make sure I'm not doing any more Bickisms. Several times I've talked about a terrific free application for creating web albums of photos on the Mac called JAlbum. Luckily, even though it was a PowerPC application written in Java, it still worked on the Intel-based Macs as well. I was delighted to discover this week that the brilliant developers have come out with a new version 7, which boasts a ton of new features and enhancements, and it's a universal binary. That is, it's been rewritten to work really fast on the Intel Macs and still works on the PowerPC Macs as well. This is great news. They have completely redesigned the user interface with the intention of making it easier to use and to be more extendable. They co-developed JAlbum on the Mac and on Windows to ensure that both platforms enjoy the enhancements together. They simplified several features, so you don't have to look at all the options all the time, but you can get to the details when you want them. JAlbum has always let you see a preview of the skin you've chosen for a web album before you wait for all the pictures to render and the HTML to be written. Now in version 7, it's done even better. Instead of pulling down on each skin option and waiting for the little graphic to update, if you just drag your mouse over the different choices, it instantaneously shows you what it will look like. As if this weren't enough fun, they've built into JAlbum the ability to FTP your albums up to your web server directly. Built-in FTP is an awesome idea because what do you want to do right after you create an HTML web element? You want to send it to your server. If you don't already have a web server for your pictures, they'll even walk you through getting an account on a public web hosting service, free or pay alternatives. They kind of did this in a build it and they will come method. There actually aren't any web host providers in there. Rather, an invitation for them to sign up with the program. This is a great idea, and I can't wait to see how quickly this fills up with hosts, hopefully before you go there and try to use it. I tested the creation of a web album, and while it was different, it was still pretty intuitive and much more graphical. You can drag in photos from multiple directories. In the old one, you had to move the files into one folder before you even started. You can even drag the pictures around to change the order, which is really cool. Oh, and they made the icon even cooler. Now it's this weird little frog guy. JAlbum was a great application before, and now it's even more fun. So head on over to jalbum.net and get version 7 for yourself. And now, a word from our sponsor. The last time Honda Bob came over, he did an entire transmission replacement in our driveway. It was unbelievable. I mean, you have to take a whole lot of the car apart to get down to the transmission. I know I'm crazy about taking pictures, and I can prove it because I took a whole series of photos while Bob was doing the transmission replacement. I had to. It was so cool that he could actually drop the transmission out and pull up another one, all in my driveway without any power tools, and the best part is that my driveway was pristine afterwards. I know, it was a little disappointing that I didn't get to use my power washer afterwards, but I was able to live with it. This is yet another reason to visit hdabob.com. He put up a web gallery of the pictures I took. It's pretty cool. And hey, I made the web album for him using JAlbum. Bob is very patient with my husband Steve and I. We ask him tons of questions, bother him with the camera all while he's working, and he continues with good humor the whole time. Go check out the pictures at hdabob.com. They're pretty interesting. There's a link in the show notes directly to the pictures. Well, I guess this is a week for reruns, but yet again, I have to sing the praises of the developer of Feeder, Steve Harris. Feeder from reinventedsoftware.com is the application I use for publishing my podcast, as well as where I create my show notes. I love using Feeder for this because with a keystroke, I can insert web links and insert images. That seems like a small thing, but every alternative I have tried makes this simple function way too hard. One of my habits as I'm writing throughout the week is to leave big gaps in the text if I haven't finished a section. I just throw in a bunch of blank lines and then I know to go back there and finish. Steve makes updates to Feeder pretty frequently, and every time there's something just cooler about it. Except the last time. Steve put in an enhancement that drove me crazy. In the old version, to force a carriage return in the way the text would display on the web, you had to hit Command Carriage Return to insert the break symbol. Well, Steve enhanced the code so a simple carriage return would do the trick. I thought that was going to be great, but unfortunately a byproduct of adding HTML paragraphs and line breaks for us was that it erases my multiple carriage returns. I thought I could get used to the change. Adapt, you know, change is good, right? Well, I realized that one of the other things I used blank lines for was to bring the text up farther from the bottom of the screen. Without the blank lines, I find my neck getting cramped as I look down too far. Well, so why am I singing the praises of Steve Harris from Reinvented Software if he did this horrible thing to me? Well, because even though I'm just one little podcaster, when I wrote to him, he explained what had changed, explained why he had changed it, and then today came out with a new version that actually has a preference so you can shut off that feature. How awesome is that? He kind of made a button just for me. Okay, maybe somebody else wanted it too, but I can be delusional and assume it's just for me, right? Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it. All right, we've got a real big problem on our Google product travels. I think they're inventing things faster than I can review them. Either that or they're moving them around a lot and just changing the order to confuse me. I do have trouble remembering what I've done week to week, so I peruse the show notes to make sure, most of the time, that I don't repeat myself. I went back to Google Labs. I thought I had finished that area, but I found a whole bunch more products that I'd never even seen before. All right, we'll have to dig in. Well, I better get at it if I'm going to keep up with them, so let's see. The next one is Google Transit. It's definitely a beta product at google.com/transit. It's a tool that helps you plan trips around a city using public transit. The reason I say beta is that it's only set up for 9 cities in the U.S. so far. 2 in California, 1 in Florida, 1 in Hawaii, and 1 in Minnesota, 2 in Oregon, 1 in Pennsylvania, and 1 in Washington. I don't know much about public transportation. In L.A., a car is a must. But I clicked on the Orange County choice for California. They had some sample searches, luckily, so I didn't have to figure out 2 addresses to try and map out. I clicked on one of the examples, and it drew a line between the 2 locations, just like the normal Google directions, with a green arrow at the start and a red square for the end location. Where it gets different is in the directions. Google Transit lets you choose the time you want to arrive at your destination, and they show you 3 different times you can leave. It shows you how long it's going to take, depending on what time you leave. This is especially important in the LA area, where a 10-minute sprint turns into a 40-minute slog if you go at the wrong time. Each of the leave times is a link, and you can click on a different time link, and you get a different route. I assume that's dependent on which bus is coming the soonest. Next, it shows you where to start, what parts you have to walk, and how long the walks will take. It outlines what kind of transportation you're going to take. In this example, it was the Orange County Transportation Authority. It tells you the names of the stops with times so you don't miss your stop. There was even a link to the Orange County Transportation Authority so you could check with them to get more information. This looks like it could be a valuable tool when it covers most cities, but for now it's more of a curiosity and a view into the future. I'm not sure if we need yet another instant messenger client, but Google came up with Google Talk anyway. Google Talk runs under Windows only, but the protocol is actually accessible on OS X and Linux through other clients like Adium, iChat, Jabber, and Game. If you start at google.com/talk, you can sign up using your Gmail or Google account username and password. You do have to enable your Google account if you want to use Google Talk. I switched over to Windows and installed Google Talk and logged in using my Gmail account. I realized I must have played around with this before because listener Leo was already in my buddy list. Jeez, my memory is bad. Well, Leo wasn't online, so I decided to add listener Ryan, which you do by sending an invite, which the other person has to accept. I sent the invite to Ryan, and he connected using the Jabber client from his Mac. I discovered in looking around at Google Talk that it has a call button, which I assume is a voiceover IP thing, like using audio chat on iChat or MSN Messenger. I tried it with Ryan, but it gave me an error message that said I couldn't talk to him because he wasn't using Google Talk. Bummer. Then I noticed a button that says Send Voicemail. So I clicked it, and I recorded a voicemail to Ryan. Then I was sitting there thinking I had to figure out where I'd sent it. Well, it turned out it was an attachment to his Gmail email account. Well, that's kind of cool. That means I have a great easy way now for Windows listeners to the podcast to send me voice recordings. All you have to do is get on Google Talk and send a voicemail to nosillacast@gmail.com. I probably won't be logged into Google Talk too often since it doesn't run on the Mac, but this could be a fun way for you to make recordings if you don't have a fancy setup. Give it a try and be sure to tell me if you do send it through Google Talk. Oh, before I forget, one thing that may be good and may be bad is that when I logged into Google Talk, I got a pop-up on the bottom right of my taskbar that started showing me all of the emails I'd gotten in Gmail. I guess if you read yours regularly on the web, this would be cool, because if you see one come in that's interesting, you can click on it right there and jump into your mail. Well, I don't use the web interface for my Gmail account. I have mine routed directly to Apple Mail, so it wouldn't really be useful for me to have the pop-ups like that. The good news is that if you right-click on the notifier, you can choose to disable notifications. That's cool. I like it when it's an option. Google Talk has some nifty features, but it would be cooler, of course, if it worked on the Mac, too. But the one thing you really need in a chat client is to have all your friends using it. If your friends out there are not there, then there's no one to talk to, and that's just sad. It will be interesting to see what happens over time. Will people migrate to Google Talk, away from MSN and AIM? An awful lot of people are using Gmail now, so I suppose it could happen. Next in the lab's lineup is Google Music Trends at google.com/trends/music. The idea here is that you can see a snapshot of the music that's popular among Google Talk listeners. Evidently, if you're using Google Talk and you opt to use Music Trends, whenever you're listening to music on your computer, you will be essentially voting for that song. You can be listening to iTunes, Winamp, Windows Media Player, or even Yahoo Music Engine. This whole thing seems a little goofy to me, but if you want to go check it out, go to google.com/trends/music to see what people, at least people who use Google Talk, that is, are listening to. Speaking of trends, they're also just plain old Google Trends at google.com/trends. I talked about this way back on episode number 43, but since that was way back in May of last year, I thought I'd do a quick run through of it to keep the continuity of our Google product study. The question Google Trends answers is how popular a particular search term was as a function of time. You can even put in multiple terms separated by columns so you can see separately how popular two terms were over time. I've had success with Google Trends before, but I found a real flaw in it when I tested it now. I did a search on the iPhone, figuring I'd see a trend upwards towards Macworld with a huge spike on the actual announcement day. Instead, I saw a big spike in 2005. Well, I'd forgotten all about the Motorola iPhone. You remember that one that was crippled to hold only 100 songs? The real flaw, though, was that the graph does not include 2007 at all. It stopped at the end of 2006, so my whole search didn't work. Yeah. Well, I tried to think of some terms that would provide an interesting graph, something that maybe all of us could relate to across the world, but all I could think of were either tragic or politically charged events. I didn't want to go there. I finally thought of something that happened before 2007, is not political, and had a tech bent to it. Remember in 2005 when Paris Hilton got her sidekick cell phone hacked? I know it's sick, but it's all I could come up with. I typed in Paris Hilton into Google Trends, and sure enough, there's a big spike in 2005. For spikes with an attached story, they put a little letter next to the spike. So the letter A was next to that spike, and the corresponding story listed on the right was her apologizing about letting all of her friends' cell phone numbers escape. Another thing Trends does is give you a graph of the cities, regions, or languages that had the most searches for that term. For some reason, Guatemala was fascinated with Paris during those years, closely followed by South Africa and Ecuador. The top three languages in which the search for Paris was made were Indonesian, Macedonian, and Turkish. Isn't that interesting? No idea what it means, it's just pretty curious. I wanted to test the comparative features, so I typed in Apple, Apple, Microsoft, and I got a blue line for Apple, red for Microsoft. It was interesting to me that Microsoft was searched on close to twice as often as Apple, even though Apple is only 5% of the market. Well, 5% when we round up a lot. The big spikes on Microsoft, though, were unfavorable stories. The top three were when the EU and Microsoft talks failed, when the EU hit Microsoft with $613 million in fines, and in March of 2006 when Microsoft delayed the release of Vista. There's also a Google Trends Chinese, which I thought about testing, but since it was in Chinese, I wasn't sure I could really provide value there. I put the link to Google Trends in Chinese in the show notes in case you want to check it out. The next Google tool appears to solve the problem of people are bored when they're at your website and you want them to wander away to something more interesting. Not sure I want to solve that problem. It's called Google Related Links, and it's a bit of code that you as a webmaster can put on your site with links to useful information, including related videos, news, searches, and pages. I wasn't sure how interesting this would be, but I went ahead and created one for podfeet.com. It's in the sidebar on the right-hand side. It probably has to scan for a while to get really interesting, but right off the bat, it started showing related searches like widgets Apple, run Windows on Mac, and BitTorrent Mac. All I had to do to create it was to agree to the terms of service, choose a color scheme, and choose a size. The size changes how many types of links you can have. In the sidebar, it's only big enough to have two, so I had to choose between searches, web pages, news, and videos. I chose searches and web pages because they seem to be the most likely to be what you'd like to see for a NoSilicast reference. I don't know if I'll keep it or not. Let me know what you think of it. If you think it's a useful addition to the site, let me know. It's mildly interesting to me. Not that interesting. If you're lucky enough to have good vision, you probably have never thought about how difficult it is to distinguish between different bills if you are visually impaired or blind. Turns out this is a pretty big problem for those folks, and a surprisingly easy problem to fix. Of 180 countries in the world that have paper currency, the U.S. is the only one that prints all bills the same size and color, regardless of denomination. In November of 2006, a judge ordered the U.S. Treasury to make paper money accessible to the blind, citing the government's violation of Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act that guarantees equal access in government programs. Sounds good so far, but the Treasury Secretary has filed an appeal saying that it's too expensive and it would be an undue hardship on the vending machine industry. Daryl Shandro of the BlindAccessJournal.com sent me an audio file that describes a petition you can sign if you think that we should proceed with the changes proposed to the Treasury. I didn't want to go on blind faith here, pun intended, that this was a good idea, so I did some reading and I think the request is reasonable. The proposal is not to have a separate cycle of changes to the bills, which would be way more expensive, but to make the changes at the same time as other changes are going through. They also haven't defined how the bill should be changed, so research into the least expensive way to do the change is quite possible. As far as the vending machine industry, I'm afraid I care a bit more about the user than I do them, but the proposal is not to change the single dollar bill, which is the most used vending machine bill anyway. In any case, you should make your own decision on whether this bill has merit, so I'll let you listen to the petition description. If you agree, I encourage you to go to moneyforall.info. That's money, the number 4, ALL.info, and sign the petition. Let's have a listen.
The American Council of the Blind is working hard to ensure that all blind and visually impaired people using United States currency have the same level of access to information about that currency as those who are sighted. If this is important to you, if you agree that you should have the same level of information about the U.S. currency that you use, now there is something you can do. Please take a moment and go to www.moneyforall.info and sign the Money for All Accessible Currency Online Petition. Again, it's at www.moneyforall.info. That's money, the number 4, all.info. The American Council of the Blind would like to thank you for taking the time to sign the online petition. Again, it's at www.moneyforall.info. That's money, the number 4, all.info.
Well, Daryl, thanks for letting us know about this. Keep me posted on the progress. I signed the petition. Listener Ryan described a common problem many people have. In using iPhoto on the Mac, if you're crazy about taking pictures like he is with 10,000 photos, iPhoto can get a bit sluggish, even in the latest version, 06, that's pretty fast. You may also wish you could have iPhoto libraries that exist in various locations, like on an external or network drive. iPhoto does not let you separate your photos into different libraries, but iPhoto Buddy from iPhotoBuddy.com does. I decided to download and install this free program and give it a whirl. The author is emphatic that it is free and he's going to try really hard to keep it free, but he's just as emphatic that if you really like it and use it, to donate to him what you think it's worth. That sounds fair to me, and he gives you plenty of opportunities to do the donation. He's got his little donate button all over the place. iPhoto Buddy works by creating separate libraries and locations of your choice. It integrates in with iPhoto very well, so it really feels like a front end to the program. When you first launch iPhoto Buddy, it comes up with a screen to tell you how to start. First, you go to the Finder and create an empty folder. This is where your new library will live. It has to be empty, and even though I read those instructions, for some reason I tried to drag in a folder full of pictures. It politely and calmly explained to me that I should pay attention and repeated the instructions even more clearly, but still politely. Okay, fine, I'll do as I'm told. I created an empty folder called Test and dragged it into iPhoto Buddy. So it came up with a window a third time, explaining yet again that I was supposed to click on the Add button from within iPhoto Buddy to select that empty folder. And it was still polite. Well, it's not exactly as intuitive as I would have liked. As always, intuitive is defined as the way I think it should work. The developer did a great job of documenting and explaining it. A normal human would have followed the simple instructions and been on their way. Once you have a new library created, you hit the button that launches iPhoto, and drag in your folders and pictures. Now when you go back to iPhoto Buddy, nothing has changed. Huh? Still an empty folder. Well, I hunted around a bit and finally noticed a back arrow button. Turns out it's a refresh library button. Now the libraries you see in the top of the list show up in an info list below. You can see your different albums within the library, and the info window shows how many items and albums you have in that library, how big it is, and any smart albums, folders, books, or slideshows you've built. To make it easier to distinguish your libraries, you can add an icon to the name instead of just a generic-looking folder. You can choose an icon, or you can let iPhoto Buddy randomly choose a picture from the album itself. I went the random method. Didn't like what it picked, but I found I could keep clicking random till it picked the one I liked. Very cool. You can change the size of these icons, too. I can see how if you ended up with a bunch of libraries, the list would be easier to manage with smaller icons. For each library, you can view the name, folder, drive, or path. Name is the option I've been talking about already. If you don't like the name of the library based on the folder name you started with, you can rename it, but the folder name will stay the same. If you click on Folder, it shows the folder name in case you've changed the library name. Drive is the next view, so in there you can see if you put the library on an external drive or a network drive. Finally, you can turn on the entire path name to where this library is located. This is an excellent feature because instead of your iPhoto library being in a predictable place, you know, /user/your name/pictures, you are now able to fling them any old place. If your memory is anything like mine, you'll have no idea where you stash them. iPhoto Buddy takes care of all of this for you. This can be especially important if you're looking for it to run a backup. You can even lock your iPhoto libraries if you like. iPhoto Buddy is a very cool little application, and it really seems to solve some real-life problems. Check it out at iPhotoBuddy.com. Thanks, Ryan. That was a great tip. Many of you probably have heard of this next one before, but I'm going to talk a bit about Adium X, which is a free instant messaging application for Mac OS X that can connect to AIM, MSN, Yahoo, and more. The reason I'm highlighting it today is that it came out in version 1.0 on Friday. It's a very well-known application that many of people have used for years, including me, so it's kind of funny to realize that it wasn't out in 1.0 before now. But it's finally out of beta. If you have friends in Canada that use MSN Messenger, US friends who use AIM, and early adopters who use Google Talk, you'd have to open three clients at the same time to be sure you could hear them all. If you use Adium, you can have all three open in one window at a time. What's new about Adium is a couple of things. They gave it a visual facelift. For example, the signature duck is more 3D, showing individual feathers. Well, you know how important that stuff is, right? Well, but seriously, they have some beautiful themes. They now see the icons for your buddies. I used to just see some sort of generic symbol, and now the pretty faces and penguins and all the other icons are showing up. When I use iChat, I can't see the cool animated icons from people's AIM accounts, and their away message is also truncated. But in Adium, if you hover over their name, it pops up with the animation and gives the full away message. I really like that. One thing I've always liked about Adium is that you can have OS X speak the messages to you. This might annoy some or even most people, but I like it because I have a habit of ignoring my computer sometimes and messages go unnoticed. But if I have it speaking to me, it's not possible to miss it. This feature does work in 1.0, but it appears to be unstable. It seems to come and go, and I have to quit to get the feature back. I went over to the website to put in a bug report, but they are overwhelmed by the traffic, so you can't actually get to the help section at all right now. I'll go back and check that out later. One of the biggest enhancements to Adium in my book is that now I can transfer files back and forth to users of other protocols. It used to be if someone was on Jabber and I was on AIM, I couldn't send a file through Adium, but I tested it with BART and it worked. That's a big deal for me. If you like the familiar sounds of iChat, you can even change Adium to sound just like it. I changed to the iChat sounds and now it feels like I'm running iChat, just with a new skin. Completely transparent to me, so I get all of the enhancement, but it still feels like home. The only thing I do lose is I can't do audio or video chats from here, at least that not that I've been able to find, but I don't do that often anyway. If you like to customize your applications, Adium is for you. You can choose from several different visual styles and a bunch of different audio choices. They have sets of audio options preset, like what kind of noise plays when you receive a message versus somebody logs in, but you can edit every single one of them. As if that weren't enough tailoring, you can go over to adiumextras.com, and there's no E in that, it's adiumextras.com, and download new dock icons, emoticons, contact list styles, message styles, sound set, status icons, service icons, plugins, Apple scripts, and whatever doesn't fit there is in the miscellaneous section. When you download one of these extras, you have a choice to either simply download, or you can go straight to installation. That method is fantastic. If you go straight to install, it installs it live in the session of Adium, and you don't even have to restart the program. The new options you pick just show up in the preferences. Overall, Adium is a great product, and I definitely highly recommend it. Check it out at adiumx.com. Well, I'm going to have to end the podcast on a sad note. I'm afraid I'm going to have to kill off the forums. We've been riddled with spam, icky, nasty, disgusting stuff, and Bart and Leo have spent a tremendous amount of time keeping an eye on it, trying to kill it as fast as they could, and sending me emails of names, usernames I should get rid of, but it's just overwhelming. I'm really sad we have to do that, but I think we're gonna cut it off. I'll probably kill it this weekend. If you know of a way to handle a PHP BB forum where it automatically kills this stuff, I'd sure like to hear about it. For example, the comments on podfeet.com get a lot of spam, but I run a tool that just, it's called Akismet, and it's free, and it simply gets rid of it for me, so you virtually never see it. I get maybe two a month that I have to go deal with. So unless I hear from somebody in the next couple of days that they know a good way to stop this, I think it's the end of the forums. Oh well, what are you going to do? I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the NoSillaCast. Be sure to keep up all the great emails. Shoot me a note at allison@podfeet.com, or if you figure out how to get Google Talk working for sending voicemails, send it to me at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.